Tender, juicy steaks. Can you think of a better icon of our pre-war artificial standard of living? And yet it was that standard that ended up being our second great advantage. The only way to supplement our resource base was recycling. This was nothing new. The Israelis had started when they sealed their borders, and since then each nation had adopted it to one degree or another. None of their stockpiles, however, could even compare to what we had at our disposal. Think about what life was like in the pre-war America. Even those considered middle class enjoyed or took for granted a level of material comfort unheard of by any other nation at any other time in human history. The clothing, the kitchenware, the electronics, the automobiles, just in the Los Angeles basin alone, outnumbered the pre-war population by 3 to 1. The cars poured in by the millions, every house, every neighborhood. We had an entire industry of over 100,000 employees working 3 shifts, 7 days a week, collecting, cataloging, disassembling, storing and shipping parts and pieces to factories all over the coast. It was a little trouble, like with the cattle ranchers, people not wanting to turn over their Hummers or vintage Italian midlife crisis mobiles. It's funny, no gas to run them, but they still hung on anyway. Didn't bother me too much. They were a pleasure to deal with compared to the military establishment. Of all my adversaries, easily the most tenacious were the ones in uniform. I never had any direct control over any of their R&D. They were free to greenlight whatever they wanted. But given that almost all their programs were farmed out to civilian contractors and that those contractors depended on resources controlled by distress, I had de facto control. "You cannot mothball our stealth bombers," they would yell. "Who the blank do you think you are to cancel our production of tanks?" At first, I tried to reason with them. "The M1 Abrams has a jet engine. Where are you going to find that kind of fuel? Why do you need stealth aircraft against an enemy that doesn't have radar?" I tried to make them see that given what we had to work with, as opposed to what we were facing, we simply had to get the largest return on our investment, or in their language, the most bang for our buck. They were insufferable, with their all-hours phone calls or just showing up in my office unannounced. I guess I can't really blame them, not after how we all treated them after the last brush fire war. And certainly not after almost having their asses handed to them at Yonkers. They were teetering on the edge of total collapse. And a lot of them just needed somewhere to vent.
He grins confidently.
"I started my career trading on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, so I can yell as hard and long as any professional drill sergeant. After each meeting, I'd expect the call, the one I'd been dreading and hoping for. 'Mr. Sinclair, this is the president. I just want to thank you for the job you've done for us, and we'll no longer be requiring you.' It never came. My guess is no one else wanted the job."
His smile fades.
"I could have gone head-to-head against the military for the duration of the war, but I'm grateful in the end that I didn't have to. When Travis D'Ambrosio became chairman of the Joint Chiefs, he not only invented the resource-to-kill ratio, but developed a comprehensive strategy to employ it. I always listened to him when he told me a certain weapon system was vital. I trusted his opinion in matters like the new infantry BDU or the Stanford infantry rifle." What was so amazing was to see how the culture of RKR began to take hold among the rank and file. You'd hear soldiers talking on the street, in bars, or on the train. Why have X when for the same price you could have 10 Ys, which could kill 100 times as many Zs? Soldiers even began coming up with ideas on their own, inventing more cost-effective tools than we could have envisioned. I think they enjoyed it, improvising, adapting, outthinking the bureaucrats. The Marines surprised me the most. I'd always bought into the myth of the stupid jarhead, the knuckle-dragging, lock-jawed, testosterone-driven Neanderthal. I never knew that because the Corps always has to procure its assets through the Navy, and because admirals are never going to get too fired up about land warfare, that improvisation has had to be one of their most treasured virtues.
Sinclair points above my head to the opposite wall. On it hangs a heavy steel rod ending in what looks like a fusion of shovel and double-bladed battle axe. Its official designation is the Standard Infantry Entrenchment Tool, although to most, it is known as either the lobotomizer or simply the Lobo.
The Leathernecks came up with that one, using nothing but the steel of recycled cars. We made $23 million during the war.
He smiles with pride.
And they're still making them today.